you're sick of hearing the anti-white message, then you've come to the right place. You're tuned in to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is Wednesday, the 17th of May, 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Today I'm very pleased to welcome to join us today the overlord of the mysterious fascists himself, Florian Geyer. Florian, how are you doing today?
Doing very, very well. I'm glad to be on the podcast with you, Sven. You know, I don't have to lasso you with an iron rod in order to keep things orderly. So it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, well, yeah, it does get a little bit rowdy sometimes on Mysterium Fascists, but it's still probably my one of my favorite podcasts that there are around. I regularly listen to it, and I really appreciate all the guests that you have on there, and especially the content that you talk about. And one of the things that you brought up in this week's episode was about the Trinity and how the Trinity itself is reflected in the world that we see around us with the subject, object, and the witness. And that got me to thinking that there are so many things around us that prove that there is a God, there is a creator, and that also prove that the Christian God is the creator. Things like the fact that he was crucified on the cross, and we have the four directions, we have the four compass points, which are in the cross point. We can look up, down, and from left to right. That's our reality, and man is in the middle of it, and Christ as man was crucified in the middle of that cross. So I thought maybe today we could talk a little bit about some of the reasons why you know that there is a God, and why you know that it is the Christian God.
Well, this is a very excellent subject to discuss. It's what I study full time at university, so hopefully I should be able to provide some answers. If we want to discuss this kind of in a more intellectual, rational way, I think that there are lots of really good proofs that demonstrate the existence of a personal Christian God. So from a basic perspective, we can look at the world around us and we find order in the world. And the Greek philosophers, especially Aristotle, talk about this order as logos, and they use the term word. And so the universe and the words that we speak are both by necessity ordered. If the words that I were speaking to you were not ordered, then you would not be able to comprehend them, and they would not be able to reveal to you the invisible thoughts that precede them inside of my mind. And so Aristotle outlined the rules of logic that are necessary to have any intelligible discussion or concept or idea. And he said that these were innate things in the world and that the structure of the universe demands or demonstrates the truthfulness of these laws. Now, he was challenged on this by a sophist philosopher, you know, kind of a relativist philosopher back in the day, who said to him, Aristotle, you know, what if I don't believe in your laws of logic? And Aristotle said, well, you just made a logical claim that you don't believe in logic. So you're using the very structure that's present in the world to say that it doesn't exist. So that's called like a transcendental argument where, you know, when you begin to argue about these questions long enough, you realize that you reduce yourself into absurdity and insanity. If you start to deny certain truths about the universe, like the orderliness, right, then the conversations that we have, the lives that we live, they lose all meaning because they don't have purpose or reference or harmony within their nature. And so, like, for me, from that point of the orderliness of the universe, we have to say, well, why is the universe orderly, right? Why is it orderly and not chaotic? Why can we understand the sense data that's beamed at our brain from our eyes? Why do all of the light waves and particles that we perceive with our eyes, why do they make pictures that are coherent and not just, pixels of color on a blank canvas? And so, you'd have to, from this perspective, right, if we look around the natural world, we can see everywhere in the natural world is so ordered, so highly complex, and to such a fine and precise degree. I believe that the vacuum of space is consistent in terms of its pressure around the universe to some absurdly fine degree. It's like, you know, 0 point, you know, and then there's like 100 zeros is the level of 100 decimal points. That's the level of variability that there is in many of these natural laws that are set up. So what the Greeks would say is that, okay, well, you know, we take a philosophical approach to it. You know, this world exists and it exists in an orderliness, right? And we know that the universe is relatively infinite. And so that means that anything that, if the universe came out of something, right, it was created, it didn't come forth from nothing, which is an absurdity, right? That, you know, you reduce the argument to absurdity. If the universe came forth from a creator or a generative power, it would have to have certain properties that correspond to the universe that we can see around us. And so the universe is orderly, so God would have to be orderly. The universe is massive and constantly expanding, so we know God would have to be all-powerful. You know, it would necessitate a perfect mind to control it and so on, so it would have to be all-knowing. And so there are certain properties, by examining the natural world and the laws that it presents to us, that we can extrapolate must exist in the creator of this world, right? So I'm gonna stop there and, you know, just ask any questions, because I could kind of ramble on all day.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm really enjoying your rambling on. If that's rambling on, I think that's a wonderful explanation of things. And it brought up a couple of points for me there, where you were talking about the absurdity of somebody using logic to argue that there is no such thing as logic. I always find it so absurd when talking to people about God, and they'll say, well, there is no God. Well, who created you then? The fact is that you are a created being that is capable of forming their own thoughts, having this conversation with me now. And you think that just happened by chance? You know, you are the living proof that there is a God. There has to be a creator. All children know this. They all know that they have a mother and a father, and they all know that something created their mother and their father. And they don't think, oh, well, it was just the grandparents. They know that there has to have been something that created the species, that created their parents. So that would be the first thing, is that's what I see around me. And the second thing is where you said there that the universe didn't come from nothing. Now, this is very important, I think, because a lot of the time you hear people saying, well, we came out of the void, or something came from nothing. And that's impossible. Nothing is death. Nothing is the end of everything. If you think the universe came from nothing, then you think the universe came from death. And you can split things into good and evil, life and death. And what that is saying is that you believe that the universe came from an evil God, if you think that the universe came from nothing. It had to have come from something. And we can see through the order of it, as you say, that God himself has this order, and he is reflected in the universe around us. And we are here to ascertain what that order is, and try and ensure that the world stays that way, like a gardener. Right. Adam was the gardener, wasn't he?
Such a great topic. I mean, because what you bring up here with the creation and the nature of God, I think ties very, very closely into you know, personal morality and how we interact with God. So what I mean by this is to say, so we Christians do believe in the doctrine of creation ex nihilo, so that God created the world there was no matter before God created it, right? God brought it into existence out of nothing. But the power that God used to create the universe was his own divine energy, right? Which, of course, is infinite and all good, right? And so it's from this divine energy that creation and life proceeds, not from the void. And that's what I think is an important thing, is that, you know, you talk to these people who believe in their own absurd, you know, metaphysics and creation story, right? So somebody who doesn't believe in a God, if you ask them the question, well, you know, how did we get here? Well, the typical scientific narrative that's given is, you know, we exist in a universe of chaos and flux, where there is, you know, constantly interacting matter that over a series of extraordinarily unlikely flukes has produced us as we are today. And we don't really mean anything in the grand scheme of things, and we're just, you know, smoke in the lungs, right? A spark in the mind kindled by the beating of our heart, and when we die, we will be as if we never had been. That's basically what they offer you, right? They offer you nihilism. And what happens is that if you say that the universe was created by an evil God, or you say that the universe was created by an indifferent God, or you say the universe the material that exists in the universe preceded its ordering, and that the properties of logic that we find are inherent to the materiality of the universe, you basically remove morality. And the reason why this happens is the view that the God is incarnate in the universe, like the whole universe and the fabric of its structure itself is God, called pantheism, right? Where God is like the trees and the cosmos and so on. And the order that we see in that is just God manifesting himself. And so in that human beings are in some way, you know, part of God. That's not a Christian idea. That's a Far Eastern idea. Buddhism and others, you know, other types of philosophies believe in this. But the problem is, you know, when you get down to, you know, thinking in this pantheistic way, you remove the moral imperative. What I mean when I say you remove the moral imperative is, let's say you're a Stoic, or you're a Buddhist, or you're an atheist, right? You know, you might be able to look around and you can see that there is, you know, there are laws in the universe, there's a certain type of rationality, and you might even admit and accept this natural law is inherent in the structure of the universe, and that it's, you know, more beneficial for us to conform to it than to oppose it, right? And I think that that's where we can find a lot of common ground with people who are not Christian, is just on that basis of natural law. But even if you come to that conclusion, and even if, let's say, you act in a moral way, you know, you honor your mother and father and you don't murder and so on, you don't have a reason to do this besides your own hedonism, essentially. You know, the usefulness of behaving in a way that's effective, the utility. Because you're not going to have to answer before a personal God that has a relationship with you and that knows you, right? And that created these laws and standards. And that is perfectly good and perfectly in a position to judge you justly. Right, that's where the moral imperative comes from. And without the belief in a personal creator God, then you cannot have that.
I think it's been the loss in that belief that we were all going to be judged, which is one of the reasons why the functions of the state has fallen apart, because people believed in the God that they were swearing their oaths to before. They believed that they were going to be judged. They didn't need to have cameras on every street corner to watch what people were doing, because people believed that they were being watched all this time by God. Everything was going to be recorded, as it were. And at the end of their lives, they would be judged. They'd be held to account for everything that they did. So people could be trusted to behave themselves. And now we have to have cameras everywhere. We're taught not to believe in God in schools, and the children run amok, and the Jewish propaganda that we get, it manages to get its hooks into us, and it manages to send us off away from God and believing in the wrong things and doing all these destructive and harmful things to ourselves. But if only we'd managed to just keep what we had when we were children, when we knew that there was a God, when we were innocent, none of this would have happened. I think this is why they try as early as they can to cast doubt into a child's mind that there is a God. And they try to take prayers out of school. They try to take church out of school and say that all the religions are the same, because they know that if a child grows up knowing that there is a God, then the child is going to want to serve God. He's not going to want to serve Mammon. He's not going to want to serve the state, because he's going to be taught from an early age that it's more important that you serve God. And if you're being taught to do something that is against God's laws, then you should stand up against that, and you should not do that. And we are seeing now in the third world, the Negroes in the third world are standing up in the churches and saying homosexuality is wrong, because they've been taught the Bible from an early age at their schools. We've now taken the Bible out from our schools. Now, I'm very sad to say Britain's one of the countries that least protested against the gay marriage laws. It all comes down to this early instruction in Christianity, which gives people it trains them in the language that's needed to describe spiritual feelings for a start. And it also gives them the strength to stand up for what is right when they are older. Even people that aren't Christians used to want to send their children to a church school, because they knew that the child that came out at the end of it, the adult that came out at the end of it, would be superior to the ones that weren't taught that. It's so important.
It's in the vast majority of the third and second world, in places like India and Africa and the Middle East, Christians are renowned for having the best education and the best schools. And so even Muslims and like Hindu pagans and so on will send their children to Christian schools because they know that they will receive the best education.
And this is interesting because one of the accusations that gets leveled against the church is that it's anti-science. It was anti-Galileo and Copernicus. And yet it was the church that always sponsored this science and this learning about the world around us. And it was the church that always taught the people. Up until we had the state schools, it was the church that was responsible for teaching the young, right up in the, even if it was just Sunday school, the kids would spend a day at Sunday school and they would learn to read and write till they're about 13 or 14, and then they'd have to go out working on the farms. But the church was always responsible for education because it wanted people to be the most highly educated they could possibly be, so that they could work it out for themselves that Christianity was the correct way. It's not about blind faith. It's about knowing that you are right from investigating everything there is to do with it.
Right. Well, in Greek, the word pistoue, which is the word for faith, means trust in something known. That's literally what it means. And so there's two things that you brought up here. I want to go back to the personal God, but you brought up something that I thought was just brilliant. And you were talking about how, you know, in Britain, the rise of the surveillance state kind of coincides with this loss of belief in a personal God who's observing all of your actions. Well, the degenerate homosexual philo-Semite Marxist existentialist philosopher Michel Foucault actually made this claim. He said that because I am free, God cannot exist. And essentially what he was saying was that if God was real, then God would be watching all of his actions and he would be judged at the end of his life for what he had done. And this guy was like the first guy to die of AIDS in France from spending too much time in San Francisco bathhouses. In his own autobiography, he talked about doing acid in the Arizona desert and meeting the devil, right? And so what happens, this is precisely what our enemies offer us is they offer us tyranny. Is they say, well, if there's no personal God, then we must be free to do whatever we want. And if that's the case, if there's no personal moral imperative to control yourself, then the only control that ever happens over people's behavior will be imposed from the outside through mass surveillance, through violence fueled by technology, right? And that means that if everything is more or less equal in this kind of grand Hobbesian, you know, Leviathan system, then kind of just whatever is the best at controlling people and producing the highest utility becomes the form of life or the form of governance that is optimal. And that's what these Darwinistic, atheistic, philo-Semitic, guys like Foucault, that's what they're pushing for. That's what they want. So we can stop there and talk about that, or I can go on to the personal God. It's up to you.
Well, yeah, I think you're quite right there. If they're going to allow people to do everything, then the state has to impose order from the outside through coercion. Whereas if you wish to do the right thing because you wish to serve God, you don't need the outside coercion. And in fact, the outside coercion gets in the way, as it gets in the way now of us serving God and doing the right thing and just living among our own kind. Because the outside coercion eventually pushes everything to try to make everyone do the opposite of what conforms with natural law. And it all boils down to this, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And this is exactly what Christ rebuked the Pharisees for. And this is, you know, people say, Christianity and so on is a Jewish religion. And on so many levels, that's false. But even on the basic level, people accuse Christianity of being kind of this like legalistic, rules-based religion. Well, there are some corruptions of that which certainly tend towards this trend, but Christianity in its original form was a rebuke of this hyper-legalism. Paul explicitly says that the law is written in our hearts, and that the man who is truly circumcised is one who's circumcised in his heart, and that what matters before God is the actions of your spirit to him, rather than just the outside obedience of the law. Because if the law is all that matters, then, well, you can twist the interpretation of the law to mean whatever you want. You can do the law in a disingenuous spirit and fulfill the outside exhortations, but inside be rotten and hypocritical. And this is precisely what Christ was rebuking the Pharisees for.
Well, that's the law is to love your neighbor as yourself and serve the Lord your God with all your heart. And in those two commandments, all the other laws spring from that and are ways to ensure that you do that. So that is within the heart. That's placed there within us by God. If there wasn't a God, that wouldn't be there, placed within our hearts. It would be dog eat dog. There would be no morality. There'd be no desire to serve God. There would just be, I don't know what there would be, just a desire to sate the pleasures, I guess.
Yeah, it'd just be slavery to the passions. And that's what ultimately... that's what happens when you remove that internal control, is it all boils down to slavery to your passions, to these irrational desires and emotions, which bring us basically to death. And the only way we would be able to counteract that would be through raw violence. But here's the thing about the personal God that I think is critical. So and this is one of the most unique, I would say the unique revelation of Christianity, and specifically the Old Testament. So the in Greek thought, the logos, or the orderer, the creator of the universe, was not seen as being a personal God. You know, Platonic thought, and especially Middle Platonic thought, viewed God as this kind of very high off, most alone one, who interacted with the world and created it kind of through a series of semi-personal emanations. There were different teachers who thought different things on how the universe came to be. Semi-personal, emanations. And so basically it was like a watchmaker using AI programs to interact with, you know, the watches that he's created. There's not a personal relationship. God was not an entity in the sense that we understand an entity to be something that you could have a relationship with. Now, when Moses was before the burning bush and he asked God for his name, and God said, Yahweh, 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 I am who I am. What that is not, as some people think, a statement of that God is pure action, actus purus, as Thomas Aquinas would say, but that God is a person. I am a person. I am the God of your fathers, the one whom you can have a covenant with. In Orthodox Church, we believe that it was Christ who was speaking to Moses through the burning bush. That the revelation of God is always from the Word, the Logos, which was incarnate in the man, Christ Jesus. And so we believe that the entire history of the Old Testament is a prefiguration of the incarnation of Christ as a man. And so the reason why this is critical, the personal God, is that I think there's two reasons. One is that, as we said, this personal God you can have a relationship with, like you can have a relationship with your father or your mother. And so this is how God is described for the Israelites, for those whom he has chosen and those whom he loves, is God is a father. God is a father. And that's the relationship that we have with him. But the nature of the Trinity is it's not just one person, that God has one life, one divine existence. But in God is community, is a social existence. And so the three persons of the Godhead can interact with each other without losing their essential unity. And we as Christians are called to imitation of this. And so when we interact with God, it's all about that personal relationship with the community of the Godhead. And it just as we interact with the community of our father and mother that produce us, and so on. And so this personal relationship is necessary for any moral agreement, you know, because if there's basically there's been two solutions in history to solve the moral imperative. There's been karma, which is like it's just like a computer program, essentially. There's nothing you can do about it. With karma, it's just if you do things selflessly, then you get good karma, and if you do things selfishly, you get bad karma. And you know, it's tyranny. Karma is tyranny in that sense. There's no there's no loving administrator or judge who assigns it, or that's the opposite possibility, is that the order of the universe, moral value, punishment and reward, is assigned by a personal sovereign creator God whom we answer to.
Well, if you've got the karma side of it and the punishment, but you also have grace, that's the difference, isn't it? With the Christian God, you have grace. But if you do have grace, there has to be people that are also punished so that there are people who are shown mercy. So this is why you see punishment, chastising, and you also see grace, and you also see mercy. And you see grace given to people that you might think shouldn't have been given grace. But if it wasn't that way, if they weren't given grace, then there would be no such thing as grace. These different attributes that we have of God. And I was just thinking there when you were talking about God as a singular and as the community with the Trinity, that should be reflected in the nations of the world. We should be individuals in our nation, but we should also be interacting with the nation as if we are one. We're part of this one nation. We're part of this one white race, and we need to be interacting together as a part of that white race. And you've got the other races should be doing the same. And it's the same when you look at the animal world. You see the different species of animal that work together to do things. They are, most of them are a community, and we should be a community of people doing the same. We shouldn't be individuals. It just wouldn't work, would it? The idea of the Trinity, if it was individuals going off doing different things. Right, that's exactly. Not the order of the universe. We see this reflection in our communities, or we should do at least.
Right. No, that's bang on. That's exact. You know, when you talk about God's grace, this is something that I think a lot of Christians, they don't really understand what God's grace is, right? And to clarify, God's grace is God's energy. It is God. What I mean when I say God's energy is it's God's activity in the world that we can perceive. And so this is the grace, light, you know, truth, energy. These are all synonyms for the same thing, which is just God's presence, God's activity. And so the chastisement and reward, one has to understand is that, you know, God's nature, God's energy, which is how we know him, because God's essence, the core of who he is a mystery to us. It's ineffable. Because there's no comparison between the uncreated reality of God and the created reality that we enjoy. And so all knowledge of God comes from interaction with his revelation, with his energy as it manifests in the world. And this energy, this light, this truth of God, this is what ultimately, you know, it cleanses us of corruption and it deifies us. It makes us like God, divinizes us. We become sons of God as Christ is a son of God. Our human nature becomes filled with the divine energy, just as Christ's nature was filled with the divine energy. And we can see in the transfiguration when he was on Mount Tabor and the light came out of him. Orthodoxy teaches that this light is God's uncreated glory manifesting before the disciples. And that after the resurrection, when we're glorified, infused with this energy, that we will be like God. We will be like God in this human way. And so this is the critical thing to understand, and that God's energy is like fire. And so that when we die, the state of our souls determines our relationship with God's energy. You know, if we reject God in this life, you know, then eternity with God's energy is like fire for us. It's like it's hellfire. It's eternal torment. But if we repent of our sins, if we embrace the light, then it's the sweetest nectar and sustenance for us when we live with it forever. And that's what the punishment is all about.
It's two different experiences while being in the presence of God, since we have this eternal life, either eternally wishing you hadn't done the things you'd done, or you're going to be eternally being happy and in bliss with God. I think there's also providence involved in this, and this is another way that God can communicate with us is through providence, also through the chastising and the rewarding. And the task is to see what God is trying to tell you in your life, and you can see that from providence, from being chastised. That's the other thing, is know when you're being chastised and you're on the wrong path and you've done the wrong thing, and then go and put things right, and you know that we've got a God there that loves us, that will forgive us for doing the wrong thing if we ask for that forgiveness.
You've got to read the Psalms. As far as the east is from the west, so has God removed the guilt from those who fear him.
Very true. Florian, I'd like to say thank you very much for coming on today. I really enjoyed this. I know it's a little bit different to what we normally do, but I think the listeners are going to enjoy it too.
Really helps.
I'd like to say to everyone, if you haven't checked out Mysterium Fasces yet, please do so. We play it on Mondays. I should be back tomorrow with Dr. Johnson, hopefully. So until then, hail victory.
If you're sick of hearing the anti-white message, then you've come to the right place. You're tuned in to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.